Hello, and welcome to episode 53 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Can't we all just get along? I'm Jerry Shario, and as always, my pleasure to introduce to you the man who once said to Orson Welles, "Would it kill you to eat a salad now and then?" Nick Santamaria.
Ho! Oh, hey, Jerry, how did you know about my relationship with Orson Welles? It's not so much that I liked him, it's just that I really like hanging out in the shade.
Understandable, yeah.
You know, especially this time of year.
Yes.
We are broadcasting, by the way, from the Broadway Palm Dinner Theater here in beautiful Fort Myers, Florida. I have just driven 2 hours and 45 minutes to be here from my East Coast home to the West Coast of Florida, only to see this jerk-a-mo here. Jerry Shario, my partner, my good partner. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing exceptionally well, sir. Especially under these circumstances.
We've
been doing this for, 2 years or so, a little longer, and it's all been on a little tiny picture on my laptop screen.
I actually thought you were 3 inches tall.
Yeah, well, I give that impression to a lot of people.
Oh, I love impressionists. But, you know, it's these crazy kids today with their long hair and their Elvis dancing. You know something? It's really good to be here because right now, ladies and gentlemen, if you can picture it, we are in what's called a black box theater.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And black box theaters matter. But there's theater, the main theater is huge. It's really, really big. And most good theaters have these little side black boxes where you could do maybe a little bit more experimental theater or maybe favorite shows, you know, or whatever. You could do classes here.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a nice space. I really, really like it.
Yeah.
Fort Myers is a nice town. Really is a nice town.
It is. It's got history. The Thomas Edison, Henry Ford estates.
That's right.
Are just on the north side of town here. So as a history buff myself, I've been there a couple of times.
Uh-huh. Well, they used to come every winter.
Yeah.
And who was the third guy? There was a third guy. Was it Henry Ford? Henry Ford,
Thomas Edison.
And Debbie Reynolds, I believe.
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah. It was during her Eddie Fisher time. She was trying to get away. But anyway, this is a historic town, and it is a very – it's a quaint town. I love the buses are like trolley cars.
Yes.
That's nice.
Yeah.
And my brother and his family lived in Punta Gorda, which is about – I don't know, a half hour from here?
Yeah, about that, yeah.
Maybe so. So I used to flirt with Fort Myers. In fact, my ex-wife used to come here all the time.
Okay.
Let me just get over that. Okay, I'm fine. So anyway, I actually talked to her for the first time in 28 years.
You mentioned that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The other day, we got in touch, and it was very, very nice, I have to say. It was very nice. It wasn't a good breakup. It was an acrimonious kind of split. So all was forgiven, and everything was nice, and I'm very grateful for that.
And is this just your way of getting us into the topic for this podcast
absolutely.
Episode?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because not every team gets along, you know? But most dogies do, right? Get along.
They do.
Little dogie.
They do.
Get along.
Because you can't get one that's short, so you get one that's long. Yeah.
Talk to Marty about that. But anyway, we are here in Fort Myers broadcasting our podcast, number 53, Why Can't We Just Get Along? I think I got that right. Or Why Can't We All Just Get Along? Whatever it is.
I'll go along with whatever you get along with.
Yeah. Okay. Jerry's easy, by the way. It's all the ladies out there. He's also married.
Yeah, just don't tell my wife.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, we are here and we're going to discuss something that has been plaguing me for a long time. And not only are Abbott and Costello relegated to second-tier citizenship in the world of classic comedy for some reason, and not only that, but they are also, unless they are just kind of associated with monsters, right, which is how people, most fans look at, they're known for not getting along.
Right.
There are so many things on YouTube about, oh, they hated each other. Oh, they didn't talk after so-and-so. Oh, when Lou died, Bud, you know, took off his pants in public and started to dance. I don't know. But, you know, give me those trousers. Get out of here. What is this? But anyway, I'm a little shocked by that.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's how they're perceived. Mm-hmm. When in fact, I have been involved in four different comedy teams in the 50 years that I've been working.
Yeah.
Okay. Four different comedy teams. When I was a kid watching these guys and watching Laurel and Hardy and Martin and Lewis and all the comedy teams, I really used to think to myself, God, I wish I had a friend like that. Mm-hmm. I wish, you know, something you go through thick and thin together and you're always there for each other, or you're goofing around or you're slapping each other. Whatever it is, you've always got a pal.
Yeah.
Right. And I always wanted that. So my very first show business experience was that. I had my best friend, and we did nightclubs. We were 15, for crying out
loud.
We couldn't get into the nightclubs, but we could perform at the nightclubs. But it's so weird. But anyway, that was my first, and that lasted a few years. And then there was another one. I joined an improv company, a comedy improv company, and the star of the company, really the one of the greatest comedians I've worked with, mm-hmm. his name was Mark McCracken, we hit it off and we broke away from the group and we toured the comedy clubs and, you know, and it was difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, we were great friends.
Yeah.
But when you're together in a car all the time, mm-hmm. and in a hotel and this and that, it gets, you know,
yep.
a little tense once in a while. So that didn't last. And in fact, we broke up over a money issue, mm. believe it or not. Then there was a third one that I'm trying to – oh, it was one of my cruise ship days when I was a comedian on the cruise ships. I had a singing straight man like Dean Martin, you know,
yeah,
that kind
yeah.
of thing, while I went kind of crazy. And that was fun. And we did that for about, I don't know, 2 years or so. And then Biffle and Schuster with Will Ryan.
Yeah.
And I know we've discussed Biffle and Schuster before. You can still get The Misadventures of Biffle and Schuster on Amazon. Really funny shorts if you want to get into it. Get into my shorts. stop talking about that. ow, Abbott, stop. I think this used to be a burlesque theater because the ghost of Abbott is floating around.
Yeah, tremendously so, yes.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, that's how Will and I got on wonderfully well. So mm-hmm. that was – I finally found the perfect partner.
Yeah.
And what does he do? He drops dead. So no, he's the beloved. He really is.
Yeah.
Wonderful man. But anyway, so we want to talk about not only Abbott and Costello, but comparatively the other famous teams, mm-hmm. and how did they get along? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why do they pinpoint Abbott and Costello when in fact – every other comedy team had their issues,
mm-hmm.
you know? But we don't say, you know, Wheeler and Woolsey, oh, they were always fighting and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's Abbott and Costello for some reason. Okay, so let's discuss Abbott and Costello first. And
okay.
I want to talk about who they were as people and how that is important in, of course, getting along as a close-knit comedy team. Chris Costello always talks about it. He always says that they were together more than they were with their wives and families, you know?
Yeah.
So that takes a toll after a while, especially if you're two different personalities, which they were. You had Bud Abbott, who was apparently a very kind man, a very complacent mm-hmm. man, a man who was ruled by his horrible epilepsy. Mm. A lot of his decisions in life were made because of his malady, Broadway malady, actually. It's the Broadway malady. Oh, yeah, I know. Okay.
Yes.
But anyway, I can slap Jerry on
yes,
the shoulder now. This is great. I love this.
I'm glad it's just the one episode. Okay. Here we
of violence? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
That one episode of violence. But anyway, so Bud was a pretty compliant guy. He had a drinking problem, and he wasn't very ambitious. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say comparatively, he was not an ambitious man. He would have enjoyed staying in burlesque, actually,
right?
Where he developed a career for himself, starting as a very young man. But anyway, so that is kind of diametrically opposed to his partner's personality,
mm-hmm.
Who was probably the most confident man in America. He was very ambitious. He knew at a very young age that he was going to be a movie star. There was no question about it. He was going to be a movie star. He was aggressive about getting what he wanted.
Yeah.
He was aware of their popularity and used that as leverage when mm-hmm. he needed it. Mm-hmm. In other words, he was ambitious. He was I'm not going to say a good businessman, but he was the businessman of the duo.
Right.
And you know, he was also Italian, meaning
which says a lot.
Right. He was impulsive. He could be temperamental. All of the things that Abbott wasn't. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I have a feeling that that horrible movie they made that made Lou look like a real animal.
Oh yes.
He was not. He was tempered with kindness, with a love of children, with a great charitable heart, and all of those things as well. So, you know, he was a total person. Mm-hmm. But he had those things deep inside him that Bud didn't necessarily have.
Right.
So that's bound to cause some kind of tension. Bud, I'm sure Bud got tired of saying, yeah, talk to Lou. I don't know. Talk to Lou. You know.
Yep.
Or else, you know, being afraid to go against what Lou wanted in the trajectory of the team or
right.
for the trajectory of the team. so that must have been, there must have been some tension there. I could understand that. But there's also the closeness. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine even just that tour they did to sell $85 million worth of war bonds.
Yes.
They were together constantly mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. on a train, for crying out loud. You know, where do you go?
Yep.
On a train. So, you know, so yeah, I could see how things would get tense and all of that. Then there was the what they claim to be I'm such a jerk about this, but I'm not convinced that their memories were correct.
Okay.
And I'm probably wrong, but I'm Italian and I'm very stubborn. So, and you are too.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, whatchamacallit? What was I saying? Oh, what was I saying?
I'm assuming you're going on to the reason for their big argument.
Yes, the big argument that they claim was 1945.
Yes.
Now, here's why I am hesitant to completely believe that. The issue was that Lou Costello discovered one of his maids sort of organizing the other servants in the house, you know, probably to ask for more money or mm-hmm, whatever it mm-hmm. was. But he found out about this and he fired her. It turns out that she went to Betty Abbott, not mm-hmm. Bud, but Betty Abbott, who she happened to be a friend of and a friend of another friend of Betty's. There was like a, you know, the three of them. I can't remember who the woman was, the other woman. But anyway, and she told him about it. And Betty, being a friend, said, well, why don't you come work for us? You know, mm-hmm. you won't be out of a job and blah, blah, blah. And it really does sound kind of a nice thing to do. Lou looked at it as a betrayal.
Of course.
You know, and I could see that too.
Yep.
Without knowing the facts, without knowing, you know, the friendship and all that stuff, he felt it was a betrayal. And he asked Bud, would you please fire her? You know, and Bud refused.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused the big argument of 19. I'm holding up, you know, my quotation marks, 1945. Now, here's why I question.
Okay.
In 1943, they made a movie called It Ain't Hay. And in the outtakes of that movie, there are two chilling scenes of Lou just brushing off Abbott like he was an extra. At one point, he literally like moves his shoulder away from Bud's hand. Bud had his hand on his shoulder and says, get somebody else. This guy's, you know, this guy's no good. Get somebody else. It's really chilling. And poor Bud is in the back, you know, trying to smile and pretend nothing happened. And then there's another scene where he calls him a chump and, you know, the chump forgot to give me the tickets and da-da-da. Lou just seemed very petulant and very anti-Bud at that point. Now, fast forward to where everybody says it happened. They all say, oh, that's why they made Little Giant and Time of Their Lives, because Bud and Lou didn't want to work together anymore. I don't buy that, for one thing. That doesn't sound sensible to me. But when you look at the outtakes for Little Giant, which is the important one, that's the one that where they supposedly weren't speaking,
mm-hmm.
They're having fun. They're making the cast laugh.
Yeah.
They're making each other laugh. They're friends. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're friends. Whereas in 1943, it looks like they weren't friends. So that's my only argument. I could be wrong. It could be that they settled things before they started shooting Little Giant, but the die was already cast. I don't know. But let's talk about that for a second.
Okay.
Little Giant, they're not a team.
Right.
Right? Bud's got two cockamamie roles. Mm-hmm. It's a mm-hmm. Lou Costello movie.
Pretty much.
And then the next one is, you know, more equal. Bud's got right. a much better role. And Lou, of course, it's still a Lou Costello movie. But how could I put this? Here's these two anomalies,
mm-hmm.
these two separate movies. Unlike anything they'd done before,
right.
they were going to continue that way?
Yeah.
I mean,
no.
They couldn't.
No.
Right? So
no.
What's this whole thing about, oh, no, they wanted to break up, so they made these movies. You know what? Here, let's play writers. Let's play okay. writers at Universal.
Okay. Okay.
You're Edmund Hartman, and I'm Fred Rinaldo.
Okay? Sounds good. Okay.
Right, whatever. All right. And I'm going to say,
Let me get my motivation here.
Okay. All right. Good.
Let's go.
We are
let's
in
go.
A theater.
Yeah, yes, yeah, we are.
Which is
that helps.
Cool. Yeah. But anyway, give me laugh. But anyway, so we're two writers at Universal, and
yeah.
I say to you, I come in one day, and I say, you know what? Bud and Lou are arguing. You know what we should do?
What's that?
Let's write a movie where they don't have to be together, and that way we're helping them.
What a brilliant idea.
This is why we make the big money here at Universal. You know? And I hear Marjorie Maine and Percy Kilbride were caught doing it in the dressing room. So let's write a romantic comedy about them. Okay, so you see that little...
That makes no sense.
Absolutely. I mean, really. I just... Guys, I'm going to leave it to our audience to ponder this.
Well, the evidence that you put forth on this is sufficient for me.
It seems that way.
I mean, those outtakes, particularly from It Ain't Hay, say it all right
yeah.
there.
Oh, yeah. And it's Lou feeling badly about Bud.
Yes.
You know? So I don't know. And everybody from their family to Bud during the This Is Your Life episode,
mm-hmm,
they
mm-hmm.
all say, oh, the argument of 1945. But that's looking back 10 years,
right.
you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's what I'm putting out there, folks. I know I wrote about it in the book as well, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, the definitive book about Abbott and Costello and their movies.
Available wherever fine books are sold.
Yeah, Larry Fine Books. Hey, Mo, here's a book.
A Fine Stooge. That's actually a pretty good book.
It is actually up until Bert Kern's book about Shemp.
Yes.
Which is an amazing book.
Okay.
One Fine Stooge was the best book written about them.
There you go.
Because everything else was kind of like fan stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. It was
yes.
like cheap. But anyway, so that is my thing about the thing about 1945. Now, I can understand that maybe as things were progressing and they were going into the 1950s and they were very, very busy. Lou was in and out of bed, you know, with mm-hmm. rheumatic fever.
Mm-hmm.
Bud's still getting drunk at 4 o'clock, you know, and,
yeah.
you know, having
yeah.
to be driven home. Not because he was drunk. He just didn't drive.
Right.
He wasn't the driven member of the team. We don't fake laugh, folks.
Oh, my God.
But anyway.
I mean, technically, he was the driven member.
You're absolutely
sense,
right. You're right. I know. But it was so much fun.
But it was such a good joke.
It was a good joke. It really was. I will admit it. It was a good joke. No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Ow, Bud. Even your ghost slaps hurt. Oy. But anyway.
Yes.
So that's that. I can see how, as time went on, Lou being 9 years younger,
mm-hmm.
having a bunch of stuff in him to, you know, perform and wanting to do,
right,
would get impatient
mm-hmm.
with Bud, because Bud, number one, was slowing down. He was not; his timing was not as great,
right,
as we went on. The boys in general were getting bored making movies,
right.
I know that television was their new passion, but even there, Lou was doing 80% of the stuff.
Oh, and, you know, at least. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Bud was settling back. So I could see how maybe there was a little resentment there, mm-hmm. or maybe a desire to end what he was seeing or yeah. whatever. But apparently the breakup was acrimonious. It was not a friendly mm. breakup. Lou, we talked about this.
Yeah, in the Vegas show.
The
yeah.
Vegas show. I believe it was the Sands. And there are two versions of it that were told by people who were there.
Yeah.
The first one was Sid Culler, who wrote the show they were doing at Vegas. And it was all new material. In fact, it was topical material. And Lou couldn't wait to do it. Bud fought them every step of the way. Can't we just do, you know, the lemon bit, or can't we just... He wanted to do what he was familiar with because that's what he could remember.
Yeah.
He was drinking a little bit, you know, whatever. So Sid Culler said that that actually happened that one night. They did their early show, mm-hmm. and which went like gangbusters. They got standing ovations. And then Bud went out gambling. And they kept feeding him drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And by the midnight show, he was blotto. And Lou was just beside himself. He couldn't believe he had to deal with this, and he had to cover and all yeah. this stuff. And that they say that night, he told them, after this gig, we're done. You know, we need to go our separate ways. And Bud said, yeah, okay, if that's what you want. And he didn't want that. He couldn't afford it.
No, no.
He couldn't afford it. Lou could line up work. You know, mm-hmm. he could do that. But not so easy.
No.
Straight men, they're not as respected for some reason, for some stupid reason.
Yes.
Because Bud was perfectly fine in that GE theater he did with Lee Marvin. He was perfectly fine.
It was wonderful, yes.
He could have been a regular television actor.
Yep.
But, you know, I guess when you hit the skids, everybody knows it. And nobody wants to be around yeah. failure. You know,
yeah.
It's terrible. But anyway, so I could see that Lou was ready to move on. I don't think they spoke after they broke up. That's my opinion. I think maybe Chris Costello would think differently or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And no offense to Chris, but, you know, certain things are repainted in a yeah. brighter color, you yeah. know. But from what I understand, they didn't talk. Bud didn't even know Lou was sick when Lou died. He didn't know he was in the hospital. But Lou was Bud was very affected by the death. Mm-hmm. For several reasons, I'm sure. Number one, he was a friend.
Yeah.
He was a dear friend. He was family,
yeah.
basically. And it meant that Bud gave up hope of ever teaming again mm-hmm. and doing good work. But anyway, my good friend, Doug McEwen, was the last person to interview Bud in, I think it was 1972 or 73.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that when Bud talked about Lou, he would tear up. Mm. And he said, there was no doubt in my mind that he loved Lou.
Wow.
So, I'm tingling right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they loved each other like brothers. Mm. They loved each other. But like brothers, they argued.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
How could you avoid it?
You can't.
You know? What do you mean you can't?
That's what I said.
I don't want to hear it, okay?
Well, too bad.
All right. You see, that's an example of what could happen. All right, so Jerry, you're so good. You're right there,
and you're right there.
Yes, I am.
I'm still getting used to this. You being right there.
Do I smell that? you know, but there was a chance that I would have showed up, and we just kind of repulsed by each other.
True,
but that's for later. I wanted to talk about some other teams now.
Yes.
In comparison, since we've discussed Abbott and Costello pretty well, let's go back a little bit to Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy.
Okay.
This one's a little more complicated in that Laurel and Hardy couldn't have been more different. They couldn't have been
right.
more disparate in personality and their likes and what they did and just their countries, mm-hmm. you know, where they were born. Stan born in England, Ollie born in Georgia.
Yeah.
Not Russia, but, you know, Georgia. can you imagine?
Hey, look, Stanley, comrade.
Hello, Ollie. Why are you wearing red? well, I didn't know. But... So, you know, they were very, very different. Stan was all about work.
Yep.
But when he wasn't working, he was all about women. Okay. He was quite the woman guy.
Yep.
Married, what, like seven times, I think? Something like that.
Yeah.
Drinker.
Yep.
All his life. But then you go to Ollie. Ollie, obese, mm-hmm. insecure mm-hmm. man. But apparently, from what I hear, very kind, very gracious, very gentlemanly.
Yeah.
Very good to people around him, which I love about Ollie.
Yeah.
A natural in front of the camera, whereas Stan was not.
Yes.
Right? For yes. the good few years, it took him a long time mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to get situated.
Well, now, and I'm sure that's all part of their initial upbringing, their training in the field, because Ollie started in the movies.
That's clearly. Right. Exactly.
And Stan was a music hall, you know, stage performer for mm-hmm. so long.
And in fact, Chaplin's understudy
yes.
for a while and roommate
yes.
for a while. So that's, you know, that's no small thing. But anyway, it says so much about Stan, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. he wasn't Chaplin. Nobody was Chaplin.
No.
But that says a lot about Stan. But anyway, so you had Stan who had that background. Ollie, who was more of a playboy. He enjoyed gambling. Mm-hmm. He loved the racetrack. In fact, that's why he had to keep working. he loved golf and was one of the best golfers in Hollywood.
Wow.
And used to win the studio
tournament.
That too. Yeah. He used to live in a studio tenement. He wrote a symphony about it.
Oh no.
big Store fans. But yeah, he was an amazing golfer and he loved sports. Mm-hmm. He loved to cook. He loved to eat. Mm-hmm. But the two of them were not friends. When they started out, Stan was slightly resentful about having to be in a team.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is, and this I think I'm the only person I've ever heard say this, but everybody talks about how Ollie needed Stan. Ollie needed Stan. Mm. Otherwise, he was a supporting player, yeah. You know, or a villain or whatever he was.
Yeah.
But I think it's the other way around. Mm. Stan was trying to find himself in silent films. Okay. He eventually went the Mel Brooks route and did parodies.
Yeah.
You know, but you could only do those for so long, as Mel Brooks will tell you.
Yes.
You know, where was he going? He had already designated himself as a writer director, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's where he would have gone had not Ollie tiptoed into his life.
Right. Makes perfect sense.
Right. And he's Ollie set the tempo. Mm-hmm. Ollie gave Stan some place to go, you know?
Yeah.
Otherwise, Stan was this obnoxious, laughing at his own jokes, jumping around when he didn't have to.
Yes.
You know, that was Stan.
Yeah.
So thank God for Ollie. And mm-hmm. they created one of the funniest comedy teams of all time. I watched them the other night in the Fixer Uppers, and I'm still laughing about it. It's so funny.
That's a good one.
Oh, so funny. At least I'll be rid of you. Oh, that's my favorite line. I don't mind dying. At least I'll be rid of you. And Ollie's so slim in this one. You know? I have a little trouble watching really fat Ollie. Yeah. It's uncomfortable. He's sweating. Mm-hmm. You know, he's mm-hmm. It's difficult. The stuff he has to do, the physical stuff, it's 10 times more difficult for an obese man, you know, than anyone else. But anyway, regardless of that, they were not friends while they were working. Mm-hmm. They got along well on the set.
Yeah.
You know, Ollie was very complimentary about Stan. You know, talk to Stan. He's the guy. Don't talk to me. Talk to him. So they were very congenial, but they weren't friends.
Yeah.
They became friends, kind of forced into it when they did those tours.
Yes.
When Hollywood closed the door on them and they were forced to do those live shows, which practically killed them. That's when they bonded. Mm-hmm. They got together mm-hmm. and they realized that they could be, you know, congenial, close friends.
Yeah.
So that's kind of nice. But they had their bumps along the way.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Stan just did not get along with Hal Roach, especially after the debacle of filming Babes in Toyland.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Roach had a completely different idea in mind. Stan nixed it. Roach resented it. They did not get along. Mm-hmm. And Ollie was in the middle because Ollie, believe me, he needed the job, you know, and he was grateful for Stan, definitely grateful because it made him a star, mm-hmm. you know. But he always thought Stan should just calm down. Let's do what he says. Let's not make waves. Mm-hmm. And that was a point of contention between the two of them. Stan wanted to just go off and produce his own films.
Right.
So that was kind of wonky. And then Ollie, who had a separate contract from Stan, Stan's contract ended before Ollie's.
Yes.
So Ollie had to make a movie without Stan. He was under contract, mm-hmm. or else go on suspension, mm-hmm. and he couldn't go to the racetrack or pay his alimony.
Yeah, yeah.
Poor Ollie. So, whatchamacallit? So, I'm sure Stan didn't feel great about Ollie making a movie without him, and especially since Roach was touting this new comedy team of Harry Langdon and Oliver Hardy.
Oh, my God.
Right? And Langdon was a friend of Stan's. They were good friends.
Yeah.
Langdon wrote on Blockheads and a few of the mm-hmm. Swiss Miss and a few mm-hmm. of their other movies, but whatchamacallit. So that must have been a little weird. Not as weird as the new movie about them or that recent movie about them.
No.
Stan took it like a man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He congratulated Ollie. He said, "Go ahead and do it. We'll get together afterwards when your contract is up." So anyway. Then there was a thing I read recently on Facebook. Somebody posted a letter, I believe it was from Ollie, to a gossip columnist who reported that Laurel and Hardy were splitting up. They were angry and splitting up. They had an argument. And Ollie, I think it was Ollie, and please forgive me for not having the facts straight in my head, but the point is, it was true. They got into an argument. This was like late 40s, maybe early 50s. Uh-huh. And Ollie tried to quell, the rumor and whatever. But there actually was a moment there where they had a bump,
Okay.
But then it was congenial until the end, and they were fine. But my point is, every team has a thing.
Yeah,
but because of those things that I just mentioned about Laurel and Hardy, they don't say, "Oh, Laurel and Hardy, they never got along. Oh, they were terrible." But I will say that Martin and Lewis do have that reputation.
Yeah,
It may be even more so than Abbott and Costello.
Yes,
and for good reason, I think.
Well, exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's also another made-for-TV movie about them,
which is almost as awful. That's the other one. And Jerry was involved. So Jerry
really?
was completely innocent in everything. And Dean was the villain in the movie.
Yes.
I hated that movie.
Not
quite as much as the Bud and Lou movie. But okay, so Wheeler and Woolsey, just very quickly. Wheeler and Woolsey, they were not a comedy team. They did not come up as a comedy team. Robert Woolsey was a stock player in musical mm-hmm. comedies, and eventually was hired by Ziegfeld for a show called Rio Rita. Burt Wheeler was a vaudeville star. Started out with his wife. It was Burt and Betty Wheeler. They became headliners. She left him and ended up being obscure. and Burt went on to star on Broadway and become a big Broadway star.
Yeah.
And he was also cast in Rio Rita. And it just so happens that the two characters, the one that Robert Woolsey played and the one that Burt played, happened to be together in most scenes.
Yes.
So they were perceived as sort of a comedy team. But then Robert Woolsey took another show after, I think, 9 months or something. He left the show, took another show. And Walter Catlett, who I love, who I think is funnier than Robert Woolsey, he took over in the role. And Bert and Walter worked beautifully together.
But Wheeler and Catlett doesn't have the same ring.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And maybe if there was a ring, it would have been a better relationship.
Exactly.
But anyway, that was really, really out there. That's my book of jewelry jokes. There's a gem. All right. But anyway, what was I saying? Wheeler and Woolsey. Yeah. So Walter Catlett comes in and he makes the mistake of leaving a little early as well. He mm-hmm. actually did the show longer than Robert Woolsey.
Yeah.
But then he got hired away to do something else. Might have been the Follies. I don't know. But Woolsey came back into the cast. Uh-huh. And that's when RKO said, "You know what? Let's hire these guys for the movie." And Walter Catlett missed it by that much.
That much.
So once they showed up in Rio Rita, it was kind of perceived that they were a team.
Yeah.
They were not billed that way. Bert was the star, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. Woolsey was – they felt Woolsey was replaceable. Mm. In fact, one of the replacements they thought about was Walter Cowan.
Of course.
Andrew Toombs was another one. I forget. But anyway, there were other people they had in mind. But they ended up staying together thanks to the aggressive nature of Robert Woolsey. He was the one that went into the office and screamed his head off. And Bert hated making movies and just wanted to get back to New York. Uh-huh. So that was their big contention, is that Bert just wasn't into it. He did his best.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's great in the movies.
He is.
But Robert Woolsey kept saying he wants, you know, to perform for 1,500 people in a theater where if we make a movie, 15 million people will see it.
Yes.
Why would he do that?
Yeah.
They never understood each other. Bert just loved a live audience.
Yeah.
You know, and he was great in front of a live audience.
And I have to say, I can't argue with him.
Oh, no, me either.
You know, there's just something, that magic, that spark.
Oh, there's no, it's not for nothing that I'm mostly a stage actor.
Yeah.
Because I love relating to an
me
audience.
Too.
Oh, and what's better than laughter?
Nothing.
Nothing. I'm telling you, folks, nothing is better than making an audience laugh. There's something almost holy about it. It's just wonderful. But anyway, so that's Wheeler and Woolsey. That was their bone of contention. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they were friendly. They were friends.
Yeah.
You know, my friend Dorothy Lee, who was a dear friend, she used to tell me about them. And she loved Bert because Bert was so laid back, you know, and the two of them loved to dance together and, you know, make up their routines and mm-hmm, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And she said Woolsey was a pain in the neck. he was cheap. She said he was tighter than a snare drum. That was her term.
Wow.
And also, you know, just kind of he would try to tell you how to do things mm-hmm. and stuff. He was mm-hmm. kind of pushy, which is kind of interesting because he really wasn't a star when he became part of this.
Right.
So I guess that became part of his psyche. So that was Wheeler and Woolsey. Okay. So we did Wheeler and Woolsey. We did Laurel and Hardy, probably the two most – no, definitely the two most popular teams during the 1930s, mm-hmm. during the Depression era. Mm-hmm. So then you had Abbott and Costello. Now,
yep.
following Abbott and Costello, we had, starting in 1946, we had Martin and Lewis. Mm-hmm. Now, here we were again, two people who were so different.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's start with Dean. Dean, born to a very stoic Italian family. They were not huggy. They were not kissy. Mm-hmm. They didn't share their inner thoughts and sensitivities. They were tough to get to know. They were secretive. I mean, that was Dean.
Yeah.
That was Dean. Charming when he wanted to be.
Yeah.
You know, laid back. Stubborn. But, and... a talent. He was he I never thought Dean was like an explosive talent like
no.
Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra is an explosive artist. Mm-hmm. He's an artist. Dean, what do you say? He was a great entertainer.
Yes.
He was a charmer, mm-hmm. you know. His voice was not the best, you know, but you loved listening to
it. Oh
yeah. Yeah. He was funnier than Jerry as far as I'm concerned. I just find his sense of humor more adult, more like mine. Jerry, on the other hand, born to two people in a lower level of show business, mm-hmm. so they were away a lot. They had to do the road a lot, Catskills and all that. So when he was born into that family, and he was pretty much left with his grandmother most of the time, or other family members. So he never felt wanted. Very, very insecure, very feeling unloved, you know, mm-hmm. and that made him the monster that he eventually became.
Yeah.
People like that have two choices. You either look at it and say, you know what, I'm not going to spread that around. I'm going to have a family. I'm going to be loving. I'm going to be the opposite of what they were to me.
Yeah.
Or you could be like Jerry Lewis.
Yep.
And make everybody miserable around you, including his family, his children. Mm-hmm. I just can't get over that.
Yeah.
I can't get over it. What a jerk. Anyway, so you had Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, who I always looked at, and I've said this before, as two really good entertainers in a very uncomfortable marriage. Right?
That's a great way to describe it.
But
yeah.
It's so true.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll tell you how I feel, why I feel this way, or one of the reasons I feel this way. When I watched the Colgate Comedy Hour and people are always telling me, oh, Martin and Lewis were the best on the Colbert Comedy Hour. I disagree. I think Abbott and Costello were the best on the Colgate Comedy Hour. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
But the reason I feel that way is that, number one, every sketch was the same. Dean, now you know the comedy. You don't do teaching things.
No.
Right? It's one of the things we learn early on. Scenes about teaching someone to do something is really boring for the audience.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And all of their sketches. Now I'm going to show you how to make a milkshake. Oh, the milkshake. Every sketch was the same. Now, there were some bloopers and stuff actually that made it fun, but they were, you know, far and few between.
Yes.
And, you know, you couldn't count on that.
Right.
So I thought, no, sorry. The sketches were kind of lame. Mm-hmm. I even talked to Norman Lear about writing for Martin and Lewis for the Colgate Comedy Hour.
Yeah, yeah.
And his main thought was, we all love Dean. And I went, and? We hated Jerry.
Okay.
Yeah. They ended up suing Ed Simmons, his partner. They ended up suing Jerry Lewis, or actually Martin and Lewis, for not paying them for, and they used the material that they didn't pay for.
Ooh.
Yeah. But anyway, so you had that. And Jerry was just one of the neediest people in America. He was, he looked at Dean and fell in love. Now, I've been in contact with a very dear friend of mine. He's passed away since a few years ago. Rick Lertzman, who was a really great biographer. He wrote some really great books. Mm-hmm. One about Mickey Rooney, another one about the Rat Pack, whatever. But before he died, he was working on a book about Jerry Lewis that I was helping with.
Okay.
And he told me that he thought Jerry was bisexual. That he was actually in love with Dean, you know, and Dean could not give it back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Dean used to be very uncomfortable when Jerry would jump into his arms and kiss him on the lips and stuff like that. Can you imagine? Dean Martin, this macho guy from Steubenville.
Yeah.
But Jerry was enamored of Dean. Now, I'm not saying he was gay and I'm not saying he was bisexual. I'm just saying that there is a love there that is beyond friendship.
Yeah.
And Dean was very uncomfortable with it the whole time.
Mm.
And they would, you know, Jerry's book about, I love this, Jerry's book about their relationship, I think it was called Dean and Me, A Friend, Story of a Friendship.
Yeah, yeah.
Every story is about, it's like their movies. Dean is like this arrogant guy who's doing like something bad. And Jerry's the innocent who has to pull him back and show him that life is very nice and it's good and you go, and everybody's happy. So that's what the book was.
Wow.
And I'm like, you know what? I wish Dean had the ability to spell so he could write a book. But I would say that Dean and Jerry were the most mismatched team of the bunch.
Okay.
For the reasons I just stated.
Yeah.
And had the most violently aggressive relationship in regards to dealing with each other.
Right.
There were fights, there were breakups, there were constant things in gossip columns. And towards the end, it was really, really bad. Mm. When they were making a three-ring circus, which is like watching a funeral.
Mm.
That's how much fun it is.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I have to just say, I watched Money from Home recently. What a piece of garbage. I'm sorry. It's terrible. And you know what? I think they're coming out with a 3D version of it so you could have Jerry in your face, you know, just annoying the hell out of you. Oh, it's terrible. Anyway, don't buy it. I'm not.
Okay.
Anyway, so they made these movies, and Dean stopped talking to him during Three Ring Circus because it was all about Jerry.
Yeah.
In fact, here's an interesting thing. When I was about 13 or 14 years old, I'm looking through the New York paper, you know, Newsday, and there's an ad for a movie I've never heard of starring Jerry Lewis. It's Jerry Lewis in Jericho, the Wonder Clown. That was the movie. What they did was they re-edited Three Ring Circus and released it to matinees.
Wow.
Yeah. And I had seen Three Ring Circus, and I did not go because it was horrible. So Jerry trying to make the little girl laugh or the little, I don't know, whatever. Oh, I just wanted to throw up.
And it sounds like that kind of editing wouldn't have made it any better.
No. Actually, they made it shorter, which was
that's helpful.
So anyway, by that time, and then they made their last movie, Hollywood or Bust, which happens to be my favorite, even knowing that they hated each other during this movie. And Dean made that famous quote at one point when Jerry went to him, you know, in full love mode from the Love Network.
Yeah.
Said, Dean, shouldn't we try again and have the goodness that we don't have badness when we're doing the goodness? And Dean just looked at him and said, you know, right now, you're just a dollar sign to me. And they were making millions of dollars. Yeah. They were so successful.
Yeah.
But that was it. That was the end. They supposedly didn't talk, didn't see each other until that 1976 reunion on the telethon.
Right.
But I just read a new book about Jerry Lewis written by someone who knew him very well.
Okay.
And this book is amazing. It's eye-opening. Not only did they see each other before that, they they would run into each other at events, and they were always congenial, you know, whatever. There's an Eddie Fisher show that Jerry is on. It's on YouTube, in fact. Jerry's on the Eddie Fisher show. They're doing a thing in front of the curtain, and Jerry's about to sing. And Dean comes out from behind the curtain and says, "Don't sing! Don't sing!" And Bing Crosby comes out and pulls Dean back, you know? Oh, my God. And the audience just went absolutely nuts.
Nice.
But anyway, from this book,
yes,
Jerry hated surprises. It was one of his pet peeves.
And I am not surprised at that, actually.
And Jerry's thing is that he's not surprised. Yeah. That's his pet peeve. But, oh, here comes your peeve. Come here. Here's a cookie. That's his pet peeve. But anyway, what a weird name for a dog. But especially since it's a cat. But, you know, from what I hear and from what this book tells me, and it was well known around Las Vegas, Jerry knew about it ahead of time. He knew. You know, it was played out in front of the public and all this stuff, and nobody said anything. But apparently Jerry knew about it ahead of time.
Okay.
And then I think there was, you know, a few more things. And then 1986, was it? Dean's birthday. Jerry comes out with a cake. Dean was playing in Atlantic City. Jerry came out with a cake. The two of them were very, you know, lovey-dovey, and it was great. So it was, you know, I'm not going to say it was a happy ending because Dean ended badly, you know, with his son dying.
Yeah.
Pretty much he died as well at that point. But Jerry was came out of the woodwork, and they would have phone conversations late at night and talk about, you know, Ricky and you know, life, basically. And I believe at Dean's funeral, Jerry sneaked into the back so he wouldn't draw attention and was there for his partner.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, you know, I'm not going to say that it was a great, you know, this sounded very sentimental towards the end, but Dean and Jerry were definitely the template for a partnership that just didn't function well.
Right.
You know, lots of hills and valleys. And Dean often said, "I wish he never saw a Chaplin movie."
I want more pathos. I need the pathos.
Pathos was one of the Three Musketeers, I believe.
Yes.
But anyway, so we're let's move on to another team now.
Okay.
And who's next? We have
Rowan and Martin.
Okay, Rowan and Martin. Okay, this is going to surprise a lot of you, but they didn't like each other at all. They were not friends.
Oh,
they just did not like each other. It's interesting. Dick was also kind of, you know, devil may care. how can I put it? Less aggressive. Pretty much went along. While Dan was a real pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody liked working with Dan Rowan.
Wow.
He was how can I put this? An egomaniac. He was, he kind of resented. There's a clip of Groucho Marx on the Dick Cavett Show with Dan Rowan.
Yes.
And Groucho brings up that one night at Chasen's at the restaurant, he noticed Dan Rowan and he walked over, which I think was very gracious of Groucho, walked over and said, "I think you're one of the best straight men I've ever seen." And he said, "You know, Dan, you weren't very, you know, you didn't really thank me much. You know, you, mm-hmm. you seemed a little uncomfortable mm-hmm. when I said that. And he laid claim to that. He said, yes, yeah. I was uncomfortable yeah. about that, you know, because I don't really think of myself that way or whatever. So I don't think he was especially, you know, happy about the team itself. But he just, he had the attitude that I'm going to put up with anything because I'm going to get to a point where I can retire and tell everyone to go to hell. Right? And he pretty much did that. He yep. laid claim to a lot of creating Laugh-In, whereas George Schlatter right. had some different ideas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he ended up becoming a recluse. I think he bought a barge and would go up and down like the Nile and the Danube.
Wow.
And, yeah. And he would just sail around and he would type letters. What was the – his? There's a book out between with the correspondence between Dan Rowe and I think it was John McDonald, the writer. I forget. But anyway, that's what he wanted to do. And
wow.
that's what he did. Yeah. And Dick, in the meantime, who was beloved – in
oh,
the
yeah.
community,
oh, yeah.
he became a fine comedy director.
Yes.
And directed a lot of television, a mm-hmm. lot of Bob Newhart episodes.
Yeah, yeah.
And would show up on TV
yes.
occasionally. And he was a funny man.
Very.
He was a very funny man.
Very.
And I thought Dan was a great straight man.
Mm-hmm.
He really, the two of them, they would travel together during the first 10 years before they made it.
Mm-hmm.
They would, like me and my partner, like me and McCracken, we would be in the same car driving from gig to gig.
Yeah.
You know, and they would do these cockamamie nightclubs, you know, developing their act and their partnership. So it must have been tough. It must have been really tough.
I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, there's that personality conflict,
mm-hmm.
you know, one easy to get along with, the other one. Okay, so that's...
But to me, just a footnote on that.
Yeah.
The pattern seems to have been... that it's the comic who's the difficult one to get along with and the straight man who's the easygoing one.
Right.
And that just flipped it completely.
Completely. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. And I think that a lot of people say that straight men get the raw end of the deal because when the act is over, nobody thinks to hire the straight man to do anything.
Right.
Because they were never the focal point
right.
of the act. And that holds true right up to Rowan and Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Martin was, you know, the world was open to him.
Yeah.
Whereas Dan, I don't think he would have been doing much.
Right.
You know? I think he tried to host a game show at one point, and I was just,
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I saw maybe the pilot episode on YouTube. I forget. But anyway, that's Rowan and Martin. They had great success for a while. Not in movies. You know, I'm going to tell you something. Go ahead.
They made one movie, didn't they?
They made two movies.
Two. Okay.
The second one was The Maltese Bippy.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that one.
I was never able to get through. I didn't. I thought it was terrible.
I haven't actually seen either of them.
Okay. Well, the first one is good.
You can't find it.
Once Upon a Horse,
yes.
it's called. And it's a Western spoof. And it's very funny. It's 1959. It's before they really broke out and made it.
Yeah.
And they're very funny together. And every Western star, you know, and sidekick shows up in this movie. And it is so much fun. Anyway, if you can get a hold of Once Upon a Horse, it's worth your time. Definitely.
Yeah.
And you could see where they could have gone. But they didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I think the time of the comedy team was pretty much over by then.
Mm.
You know, when you think about it, the big
True.
Time movies and all that.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, so after Rowan and Martin, I just wanted to very briefly discuss the troublesome Allen and Rossi. Okay, so that's Marty Allen. Hello there. Who I've met and is a very sweet guy.
Yeah.
Very, very nice guy.
Yeah.
And Steve Rossi, a big, good-looking singer, you know, good voice.
Kind of Dean Martin-ish.
Yeah. And in fact, that's what they were emulating,
yeah.
basically.
And I think I just have to slip a footnote here that regular listeners to this podcast are probably among the few people who know who Allen and Rossi are.
And I'm hoping
yeah.
that the people that don't know who Allen and Rossi are use their Google that is right in front of
yes.
them and is just a button press away. Button press away. That was my publicist's name. Hey, Button, come here. Yeah? I want you to press these pants for me. Press away. So anyway.
Yes, Allen and Rossi.
Allen and Rossi. Now, this is fascinating. I grew up watching them on variety shows. They would show up on talk shows, variety shows. I never thought they were top tier. I always thought their material was a little lame.
Yep.
But it was fun to watch them because there was a lot of energy and, you know, the audience liked them. And Marty Allen would always close with, well, Steve would sing and Marty Allen would dance.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, how can I put this? I always felt a little uncomfortable watching this little fat man do these like Watusi moves, you know? It was kind of like watching your drunk uncle at a wedding. You know? And not a wedding you were invited to.
No.
So it was always kind of weird. But anyway, they broke up. They had sort of an acrimonious relationship, and Rossi started teaming up with different people. One of them being Joey Ross.
Oh my gosh! Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. Joey Ross, who was probably one of the most disgusting men on the planet. By all accounts.
Wow.
You know, when he would show up places, it was always with a hooker. you know, he was that kind of a guy.
Wow.
I would always see him at Cantor's in Los Angeles. Great deli, by the way. Mm-hmm. And he always had his Yankee cap on and a table full of people, and he was always in charge. But but Ross and Rossi? Rossi and Ross? I don't know what they went by. But Steve Rossi would show up with different partners.
Wow.
And eventually they got back together again, and then they split up again. And before you know it, Marty closed out his career. He married a younger woman, a country western singer, actually, and she was very good. And they did the same act. They did Alan and Rossi's act, only he used his wife as the straight man. And you want to know something? It worked.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It worked. But that's what I mean about the material. It was very... what's the word? You couldn't look at an Abbott and Costello bit and picture anyone else.
Correct.
With this, I think anybody could have done it.
It was utilitarian.
Well, there you go. Thank you. I'm not usually into religion, but
I've been wanting to use that word for a couple of weeks now, so I'm glad I was able to pull it out.
I was wondering why your cheeks were puffy. But what does that mean? The word was trying to get out of your mouth, so I pictured it puffy. I don't, you know, why do people listen to this? All right. So, Alan and Rossi.
Yes.
That's them. What else after that?
One more.
I think I know who you mean.
Yeah.
Cheech and Chong.
I never thought we would ever have a discussion that included Laurel and Hardy and Cheech and Chong, but here we are.
They're just so similar, you know, they're so similar. There's another fine joint you've given me.
Stan's not here, man.
That's great. But anyway, so you got Cheech and Chong.
Yes.
Okay. They come up during the 1960s. They are a counterculture. They're very into marijuana. And that whole scene, eventually... The thing about Cheech and Chong is I was perfectly willing to give them a chance.
Yes.
And I have to say that their albums were funnier than their movies.
Yes.
But the thing about Cheech and Chong is they were about one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it got really boring after the first thing that I watched.
Yes.
So they did not have a long shelf life. It was not it was not in the stars that these two pot-smoking comedians were going to have a long shelf life.
Yeah.
So I went to the movies. I tried to support them. You know, like I told you, I love comedy teams.
Yeah.
But I had to finally face the fact that the few things I liked on their album, and I say album because I only heard the one.
Yeah.
Were okay. You know, I didn't go around quoting them, you know. Stan's not home, man. That I remember. That was really good. And there was the one with class. Yes. That was fun,
Sister
too.
Sister Mary Elephant.
That's
yes.
it. Yeah, that was fun, too. But there weren't enough of those things.
No.
They did not have, like, Abbott and Costello's bag of tricks, you know? So they've petered out. And the thing is, much like Abbott and Costello, when Cheech finally said, I've had enough, Chong was devastated. He wanted to just keep on the gravy train, little knowing, or maybe he did know, but he was hoping to get back, you know, to their past successes.
Yeah.
Whereas Cheech saw the writing on the wall and said, it's over, you know, and he started getting work on television.
Yes.
What's the show with Don Johnson that he did?
Was that Nash Bridges?
Nash Bridges?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he had a wonderful recurring role on that. Not that I ever saw it, but you know what I'm saying. It was successful. And he went on from there.
Yeah.
And much like Dick Martin, he was embraced by the community. He made some wonderful movies on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, Chong was going to prison.
There's that. Yes.
There's that.
He did have a nice run on that 70s show.
Oh, I see. I never watched it.
Tommy Chong. Yeah, he played the photo hut worker.
What's a photo hut?
Exactly.
Well, you know, what's
back
what's
to
a
the
camera?
70s, you know?
You know? Yeah.
And he just played that same character, though. It was him.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you wouldn't want him any other way.
No.
You know, what's he going to do, Noel Coward?
Well, especially a show set in the 70s.
Uh-huh.
Which
would be perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And he's not untalented. He's a funny guy.
Yeah.
You know, and so is Cheech.
Yeah.
But it was over.
Yeah.
It was over.
Yeah.
And I don't think Chong ever got over it. In fact, the two of them got together recently.
I know.
To do something. And you know what that means. We need money. That's why you see all these rock bands out there that need walkers. But anyway, so Cheech and Chong had that, a breakup and the same kind of thing. Chong went into selling pot. And like I said, he was arrested. He did a few years in prison.
So.
Now that he's out and that pot is legal in most places, he's got a business.
Yes.
And apparently it's doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy for him for that. And Cheech, again, is, you know, he works. He does stuff. He's getting on in years and he's not doing as much as he used to. But that was their relationship.
He's got a couple of good Disney credits.
Oh, yeah.
Voice work.
That's
stuff.
Right. That's
so.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Whenever they need a stereotypical Mexican accent, they seem to go with him.
And Lupe Velez is out of town.
Yeah.
They get Cheech.
Yeah.
Cheech Marin. That's his name. Cheech Marin.
Yep.
And Tommy Chong. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So Cheech Chong. I'll get it. That's what it sounds. It sounds like a doorbell. Cheech Chong.
Yeah.
So is this the truth? We've actually finished an episode at just an hour?
Give or take, yeah.
That's so weird.
I know.
You know? But I think we're just so excited to go to lunch. And I'm buying, Jar, so you pick the place.
Oh, most definitely.
Okay.
Well, then let's cut this off, right? No.
You sound like my Moyle. And the Moyle the merrier, I always say. So, ladies and gentlemen, couple of things. Not a couple of things. I'm not prepared to release that news yet.
No.
I'll just leave it there.
Well, allow me to come in and say we hinted at this earlier in this episode, but I just want to let people know that if you love Abbott and Costello, and quite honestly, why would you be listening to this if you don't?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have a copy of the definitive book about Abbott and Costello, namely the annotated Abbott and Costello by one Mr. Matthew Conium and two Mr. Nick Santa Maria.
I love that guy.
As soon as you stop listening to this, go get it.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you very much. And you know what? It's a seriously great book about
it
Abbott
is.
And Costello. I read it. I actually read it straight through.
Wow.
With the mindset that I didn't write it.
Okay.
So as an Abbott and Costello fan,
wow,
I read it through and I thought to myself, that is the best book about Abbott and Costello I've ever read.
I could not imagine, you know, I've written a couple of sketches, short plays, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine trying to read one of them with that mindset.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
that always hangs over you.
Yeah.
Why did I put that word?
No, you know, sometimes you have to like separate yourself.
Yeah.
Sometimes the Biffle and Schuster movies, the few times I put the DVD in, I watch it and I watch it as a fan. I don't watch it as a person who was there, you know? And it's the only way to judge it fairly, basically. So yes, I do agree about the book.
Well, and allow me also to add my two cents in that I have always been a student of comedy, a lover of comedy, of old film.
A performer of comedy.
That too. And my personal library at home is chock full of behind the scenes books and the making of books and the history of this team, this comic books. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, my friend, if we were not working on this project together, I would still say this is the book about Abbott and Costello.
You are so kind, Jerry. Thank you very, very much for that. Very sweet.
Just don't tell Matthew that I like your parts better than his.
Well, you know, we won't go there. But you know, my brother, actually, let me preface this by saying that my family was not the most interested in my career. In fact, most of them don't know half the things I've done or accomplished. Nobody read the book.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
My mom read the introduction, I believe. And my brother.
So she's a John Landis fan, is what you're saying.
Yes, okay. That's it. She loves Animal House. She's constantly quoting it. You know. Not bad for a 95-year-old woman.
Oh, my God.
And you should see her do the eyebrows like Belushi. But anyway, my brother went to Italy recently, and he asked me to borrow the book. And I loaned him the book, and he read it. He actually read my book. Do you know what a big deal that was to me?
I can imagine, yes.
And he wrote back and said, you guys complimented each other so well.
Yes.
You have completely different writing styles, but you complimented each other perfectly.
Yes.
And he said, I can't believe the amount of information in this book. It's really devastating. seriously, everything went into it.
Yeah.
So I can't have a better advertisement than that. You know?
The only thing better would have been if he actually had purchased a copy of it. But, you know, that's,
yeah, I know. And I'm sucker enough to.
I've got two brothers. I understand completely.
You know how it is.
They wouldn't do. Yeah.
Older or younger?
I mean, one of each.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, one up, one down.
Huh.
And, you know, to this day, I'm in a show. You have any complimentary tickets? Just buy a freaking ticket. Come on.
Support the arts, for crying out loud. Support your brother. Now, where do they live nearby, or where do they live?
No, my whole family is up in New England.
Wow. So the Boston area?
Yep.
Wow. Okay. All right.
Born
so you
and
don't,
bred.
So you don't go in the wintertime?
I try not to, although I was just, you know, this last winter, my wife and I were on this tour.
That's right.
Miracle on 34th Street. And we were up in the Northeast. We actually got into Maine.
So you got to see your family
show.
A little bit?
Did not. Just timing and all. We're due. I'm going to reveal a little piece of personal information here. Mm-hmm. My 50th high school reunion is this year.
Oh, my.
Yes.
That means it's mine, too.
Exactly. I've never attended one of them. No,
I've been to two.
Well, for me, it's mostly been timing because, you know, for like 20 years, I was touring full time with a theater company out of L.A., and it always happened. I was in, you know, Minnesota or Georgia or somewhere, you know.
Not Russia.
No. But and so, yeah, this year my wife, she's saying, no, well, we're really going to try to get you there, you know, because it's been a while since we've seen my family. So,
well, and also that's a biggie. 50 is a biggie.
Yeah.
Now, mine's coming up and it's an interesting thing because my family moved to Florida from New York. Mm-hmm. As I was going into my senior year.
Ooh.
Which was devastating.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So I have two high schools where I ostensibly graduated from. But I never go to the Florida one because it was just that one year.
Right.
But I went to the 10th and I went to the 20th.
Okay.
And the 20th was just a disaster. I had a horrible time. Mm. And I never went again. I never went to the 30th or the 40th.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking maybe the 50th. I don't know. You know what? I'm in touch with the people I want to be in touch with.
There is that.
I really don't. I'm not curious about how anybody looks. You know what I mean? I think I'm kind of past that.
Well,
so I'm not sure if I'm going to go.
My best friend from high school. We still keep in touch. We still.
That's
in
nice.
Fact, I saw him when I was up there in New England. In
I saw
fall.
Mine
in,
yeah. recently.
And he's pushing for me to attend.
I'll go.
You know?
Why not?
Oh yeah. Well, it's just mostly going to be a question of timing and finances.
Well, so. I just also want to tell everybody out there, if you're anywhere near the Fort Myers area in Florida, take the trip to the Broadway Palm Dinner Theater to see The Wizard of Oz. They got glowing reviews, including this jerkamo here. And he's playing Professor Miracle and the Wizard.
Yeah.
Right? And yep. I love the song you have. We've got to ease on down the road. We've got to ease on down. I love that when you do the whole hip hop thing.
Oh, yeah. It's a highlight.
Excellent.
If I can keep my hip from going out when I'm hopping, but yeah.
My hip never went out with anybody. Totally solo. Sit at restaurants with books, you know, the whole thing. The waitress comes up. You want a box for that? No, but I'll wrestle you. That's one of those jokes I wrote.
Oh.
And now everybody's like, oh, yeah, I said that in a restaurant in 1926.
Oh, my gosh.
Whatever. There's like Bud Abbott used to say, there are no original jokes. There are 7 original jokes, and they're all based on the same thing. Now get out of my way. I remember when he said that. I think the interviewer sued him.
I think uncle said that first, though.
But you were really?
I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to say uncle now, and we'll finish. So, everybody, have a wonderful time. This is a horrifying summer. I want everyone to try and stay cool. I would suggest going to 7-Eleven, buying a bag of ice, and pouring it down your pants. I always found that that kept me cool. During hot summers, and it makes you kind of a good dancer as well. So, Jerry, you take good care of yourself, pal. I'll see you at lunch.
Okay, sounds good.
Adios, amigo.